Jake from McDonald. You're listening to this episode on CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting through Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coast Salish ancestral unceded territories. As the ski season approaches, I thought I would reach out to some old colleagues, two ski patrollers from Whistler Mountain. We first speak with Dan Davis, who is a current patroller, and then we speak to recently retired patroller Jan Tindall, who was the avalanche forecaster for upwards of 20 years. Song break. We're going to try something a little bit different today and start it off with a song. Dan Davis chose the song All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix. Fitting for a vigilant patroller. Enjoy.
There must be some kind of way out of here, say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine, plowman dig my earth. None will level on the mine, nobody of no reason to get excited, the thing they kind of spoke. There are many here among us but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us start talking falsely now, the hour's getting late. Hey! Hey!
Welcome back to the episode. We now dive into my discussion with Dan Davis, first with a little ode to Jan Tindall, and then we dive into his experience as a patroller, starting later in life, and moving into what it's like to search for people in the backcountry and then administer first aid.
First of all, let me say that Jan Tindall's a legend, and I was super, I know now, very, very much now, I can tell as a couple more years have gone by how lucky I was to have spent any time working with her. She was a tremendous athlete, and she was great at her job of forecasting. I make the joke that she could tell where every snowflake fell on Whistler Mountain, where, you know, behind every rock, every little nook and cranny, she knew what was going on. It was pretty great to work with her. My name is Dan. I started volunteering in 2008 as a physician that was going to enable my kids to continue in the ski program and be able to play hockey, because it takes a lot of time and energy to both do those things but also pay for all those things. And with three kids in ski programs, and I wanted all of my kids to play hockey as well, that was one way of making it happen, because of the discounted program as a family pass and discounted ski programs. Mm-hmm. I have a background in the deep dark past of spending some time outside and doing some mountaineering and ski touring, and all I had to do was take the first aid course, which I sort of figured I needed anyways if I was going to continue to do these things and if I was going to be able to take care of my family. So the original first aid course I took, the outdoor emergency care, was what was needed to be a volunteer. And that's how I got started in ski patrolling.
Right.
And a couple years into volunteering, basically once a week, some pro positions became available due to the carnage that happens to ski patrollers. We spend a lot of time on skis ourselves. And although it's rarely skiing gnarly stuff that gets us hurt, there's a high percentage of injuries every year. And they finally, enough people got hurt that they hired me, basically. So I started ski patrolling, I believe I was, as a professional, I believe I was 42, which isn't how I recommend to everybody to do it. It's probably better to start younger and maybe have more of a skiing background than I have, because I grew up playing hockey in Montreal and Ottawa, and there was not time in the winters there to or revenue to both ski and play hockey. So I've been learning to ski as an adult, basically, when I moved out to the west coast of Canada. I've been learning to ski since then, although I skied and I could make a hockey stop anywhere. But I, you know, only learned to ski in the big mountains when we moved out here in the mid-90s.
Right.
I got to tell you, I don't have specialization. We make the joke that it's we call ourselves RPG, or regular patrol guy. Having a background in the rest of my life with working a little bit with machinery and stuff, and owning a motorcycle, so that the snowmobile jobs come my way quite a bit of time.
Right.
And working to get lifts open in the morning before there's lifties around also is something that I do in there. And inside that, there's also the explosives ministry, we call it. So we have a team of people inside the overall team that maintain the inventory, the security, and the safety, and prepare the shots and distribute the shots and keep the our workplace clean and tight with regards to the explosives that we use as well.
Right. Yeah, that's a big part of what we talked about. Jan and I talked about the explosive side of things.
Well, it's, you know, it's a avalanches are one thing, but the explosives end of things is also something that, you know, that it kills people, and you got to take it seriously. And, you know, we have a pretty lighthearted work environment, but you have to pay attention, and there's no room for error in the handling and distribution of that stuff.
No doubt.
When you have a bag full of it or a snowmobile trailer full of it, you have to be aware that, you know, probably wouldn't affect you, but it would affect a whole lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it'd be. So one of the things that I gravitate towards is when there are lost souls out past the boundary and stuff like that, I get a great deal of satisfaction out of playing playing adult hide and seek or adult Marco Polo, going to find people and securing them and getting them back home safely.
Right. And was it last season that you were telling me the story about when you stayed overnight with someone?
Well, the event happened a few years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up breaking known protocol, ended up staying out with somebody that we found them. It was late in the season, so I'll paint the picture. It's late in the season. It's March 31st, I know for a fact, because there's a April Fool's tradition that was going on the following morning. And the evening of March 31st, we got a call from a group that had been in the just outside of the boundary on what's known as the south side in Whistler. And one of their party had proceeded downhill where he shouldn't have gone downhill, where he needed to either go uphill or hard traverse. And he was on his way to nowhere. And he was, his friends said he was drunk, and then alluded to the fact that he may have been high as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not that I'm here to cast aspersions or anything, but he also had no outdoor experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd already completed sweep to the bottom of the mountain. We took the gondola up from the creek and then got towed up from the creek to the Alpine Services building, which is a tree line on Whistler. And we got some more information about where this guy was, and myself and another a fairly new patroller ended up going up to the peak and skiing down and meeting his party that had come back through the boundary and was standing inbounds, and gave us a little bit more detail about where this guy was. And we left them at this point. And at this point, it's also important to note that there are two people standing by the Alpine Services building on the radio that are working with us. And we go down to the boundary line out there that we're pretty familiar with. And we cruise along the boundary line till we find a track that doesn't make any sense. And we find this guy's track, and we drop down about 50 meters or something, because the track goes the wrong way. Like, if you continue to go down, you're looking at a 8 or 9 kilometer exit. Whereas if you just walk uphill for 20 minutes, you could be in the village in another 10 minutes.
Mm.
And so he's right at that deciding point. And he's making tracks where there was, you know, nice turns to be had, but it gets narrow and narrower, turns into a gully, and there's a waterfall at the end. And then in the summer, if you fly over there, you'll see there's a collection of discarded skis and snowboards and stuff, because people just give up and walk and try and walk away from there.
Mm-hmm.
End up walking out the next morning, or they get helicoptered out or whatever. Anyways, so we drop down a few meters, blow our whistle, do some yelling, nothing. Decide, okay, you know, it's a nice night, it's sunny, we can drop down a few more meters. We drop down a few more meters, and we can hear somebody yelling for help down this gully. So we hear someone, but we cannot have a conversation. So we take a deep breath. We radio the night search manager. And he says, look, guys, it's up to you if you want to go down there, because he knows the terrain very well. And he knows the exit is you have to ski to the bottom of the valley on that side and then walk out, I'm going to say 8 kilometers. Maybe it's 10, but it's way more than 5.
Oh, God.
And so we're like, yeah, we'll go down for a bit. We go down and we keep going, and we get a little bit more sort of verbal contact with this guy. And he, we can't have a conversation with him, just shouting. Anyways, where we found him was right at the point of no return. We find him at the where it turns into very much turns into a gully, and he's got in the creek by this point, and he's wet more than waist deep wet because he's been in the creek sort of thing, and there's no place else to ride from there. He's a snowboarder, and the exit from there is up a bit higher than he was, traverse a couple hundred meters away from where you would think you need to go. So you need to go traverse left, down a couple hundred meters, traverse right, down a couple hundred meters, traverse left, and then down a few hundred meters, a couple hundred more meters till you get down to the flats, and then walk out on flats. And we peel his wet stuff off. We give him some of our dry clothes that we brought with us, some supplies. But I'm telling you, it was such a nice night, late March. Nobody thought you were going to, that you needed to bring too much. You weren't going winter camping. But we always have stuff with us, so we had enough stuff to put on this guy. Mm-hmm. We made a space poncho for him because he was wearing a cotton t-shirt and it was soaking wet. So we took a space blanket and my partner cut a slit in it and stuck his head through it, so we had a space poncho that we then put clothes over top of.
Oh,
that worked out pretty well. Yeah, I never even heard of a space poncho before that. But anyways, anyhow, so then we start trying to traverse with this guy, and he's basically, well, he's crying like a baby because he was pretty lost and thought he was going to die. and then it becomes apparent he can't keep up with us traversing. We're both on skis.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up falling off the traverse and tumbling down, or out of an avalanche path at this point, and back into the big trees. So I did not mention this whole time we were in an avalanche path.
Oh.
Now the rating was low, low, low. There was zero chance of avalanche,
mm-hmm.
but nonetheless, you're in an avalanche path. And then if you step a few meters to the left of this avalanche path and you're in and around trees that are clearly 150 years old, you realize that avalanche path goes big and, is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, we're out of the avalanche path. This guy tumbles downhill and comes to a halt below one of these big trees in a place that's you would never camp there. It's too steep. But he's just sobbing and unable to take care of himself and pretty drunk. And now we got about 20 minutes, half an hour before it's going to be dark.
Mm.
I had hoped if we could have made the exit trail by the time it got dark, we had just walked out with headlamps.
Mm-hmm.
Myself and my partner could have done it, but we couldn't do it with him.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to come to a complete stop. We decided to come to a complete stop. We're camping here. So we made a snow camp out of, we got our shovels out and started digging. And I didn't mention at the beginning, we are beacon shovel probe, beacons on,
mm-hmm.
ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so we start building this sort of amphitheater on this pretty steep slope with a big tree that had to have like at least a meter diameter sort of as the point of this uphill triangle. We make a couple of benches,
mm-hmm.
and we take our Leatherman out and we slice a bunch of boughs off pine trees, and we mm-hmm. make some insulation for ourselves.
Nice.
And we start pulling together any dry thing we can find to make a fire. on this slope, so we had to like bang sticks into the snow so that it would sort of keep the fire in one place and use the tree as a reflector. And now it's awfully close to dark, and we realized that somehow neither of us have a lighter, and our new best friend also doesn't have a lighter. But my man, my partner, pulls out his Leatherman, and he's got a flint striker on the back of it, and lights a fire in not more than 20 seconds with a flint striker. It was awesome. So we celebrated pretty hard because we didn't want to have to cuddle up with that skinny guy from Australia all night to keep him alive. So then it became, we were able to make a radio call and say, hey guys, we're stuck. This is where we're at. Hoping for an extraction in the morning. And then we had to just sort of keep that fire going and keep our buddy hydrated and try and keep him warm through the night. But like I said, it's late March, and it was a super nice night. We had a weather report, and it was going to be clear, but it wasn't going to be cold. There's no new snow coming or anything. And so we spent the night like that, scavenging for wood, and kept the fire going until, well, basically until the sun came up in the morning, and Whistler Search and Rescue showed up with a couple of team members on a long line, and the pilot happened to be a friend of mine, and he described it. I tried to tell him where he was and told him that I left, you know, a snowboard and skis out in the avalanche path in an X so he would see us, and he was just said, yeah, the usual spot. He came around the corner and went to the usual spot and found our stuff. And the two members of Whistler Search and Rescue, after a reconnaissance flight, came back at the end of the long line. They got off of the long line, came, and then one of them left with the subject. And then they came back and took my partner out with the next guy and left one with me. And then I was the last guy out. And we signed out of work that morning at... I believe it was about 9:30 by the time I signed out.
That was just a little bit of my chat with Dan Davis. Unfortunately, we only have a little bit of time here, and we're going to get to Jan Tindall, but enjoy his closing comments.
Pretty much. If you have anything you'd like to add about how people can get into it if they're interested, now would be the time.
Volunteer programs are... there for a reason. They use it as like intro to ski patrolling, and it can weed out the people that don't want anything to do with it in a hurry. There is a lot. There's one of those things that go around the internet, what my mom thinks I do, what my boss thinks I do, what I think I do at work, and we spend a lot of time de-rhyming stuff, standing up bamboo and walking around in all kinds of weather and stuff, but it's still a rewarding job. So if you can get the appropriate occupational first aid course or a outdoor emergency care course, it's a way to do some first aid. Most first aid jobs, all you ever do is paperwork and hand out band-aids. But you'll find that ski patrolling as a volunteer, you will splint wrists and sling shoulders and put people in leg splints and put people on spine boards and in backpacks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you will get hands on experience. And I believe virtually every mountain has a volunteer patrol of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to get there in November and then and let them know you're there so that you have the opportunity to do it. You can seek it out. You seek it out online and then find who you need to get a hold of and get after it. It's tons of fun.
Yeah. Love it. Okay. Well, if you have any more closing thoughts, go ahead and share them. But if not, I think that's been pretty great.
Mm-hmm. I have, well, I'll tell you what one closing thought is. Mm-hmm. Is find something lucrative to do the rest of the year, because mm-hmm. nobody wants to pay you a lot of money to do what we do.
Noted. You hear that, folks?
But you do get the goods, and it is a good time.
Righto. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks for the opportunity, and let me know if there's anything else I can do for you.
Yeah, we'll do. Bye-bye, Dan.
Okay, thanks, Jay. Bye-bye.
So, break. Before we jump into our interview with Jan Tindall, I thought I would do the same thing and play her song beforehand. For a little bit of background, this song comes from the Rio Samaya band. They are a duo, Vancouver-based, named Pancho and Sal, partners in love and in music. They play kind of Latin genre, and they have a goal to collaborate with as many community artists as they can. This one is called The Baja Waltz.
When the night arrives,
y todo se calma,
and everything is calm,
las estrellas parecen,
the stars seem like
millones de flores,
millions of flowers,
y en el silencio,
and in the silence,
los corazones,
the hearts,
palpitan más fuerte,
beat much stronger.
En las noches de Baja,
in the nights of Baja,
y en el desierto,
and in the desert,
nos encontraremos,
we shall meet,
con la luna alumbrando,
with the moon shining,
nuestro amor será eterno,
our love shall be eternal,
sin fronteras ni tiempo,
without borders or time,
el futuro espera,
the future waits for us,
y en el silencio,
and in the silence,
tú y yo bailaremos,
you and I will dance,
vamos girando y vamos cantando, la vida es un baile y hay que bailar. La vida es un baile y hay que bailarlo.
That it shall never end.
Este baile de ensueño,
this dance of dreams.
Tan lindo en los brazos,
so beautiful in your arms.
Y en los cuerpos moviendo,
and in the bodies moving.
y escuchar el mar.
And to listen to the ocean.
Besando la arena.
Kissing the sand.
De la misma manera.
In the same way.
Esta noche haremos.
Tonight we shall do.
Vamos girando y vamos cantando. La vida es un baile y hay que bailarlo. Y vamos girando y vamos cantando. La vida es un baile y hay que bailarlo.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today. Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Tune your radio to the CITR 101.9 FM on a Tuesday, specifically at 1 p.m. or 11 p.m. for saxophone Hello Primiti or saxophone La Nuit. Hosted by moi, accompanied with the improvisationalists, saxophonists, composers, and musicians of our great era since the 70s. Featuring artists such as Anthony Braxton, Albert Ailer, Solange, Ghostface Killah, Ornette Coleman, Sonny Ryan, that's 1 p.m. or 11 p.m. on a Tuesday to listen to saxophone a la Primiti or saxophone La Nuit.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Outdoor Pursuits, and we are broadcasting through Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, and Coast Salish unceded ancestral territories. We're back here, just as a reminder, speaking with Jan Tindall, retired avalanche forecaster for the Whistler Patrol.
Hi, my name's Jan Tindall. I worked for Whistler Mountain for, I guess, about 38 years when I moved to Whistler, and then worked a few different jobs and did lots of skiing, and then decided that I thought ski patrolling looked like it might be a really good fit for me, a great outdoor job, and got to ski lots. So I ended up getting a job. I worked first one trip at Cypress Bowl to get a little bit of experience, and then they hired me on at Whistler, which I ended up working as ski patroller for, well, all those years, 38 years I was part of the patrol. But after about 10 years, I got really interested in the avalanche side of things. We all did avalanche control as ski patrollers, but I got interested as well in the avalanche forecasting side of it. It ended up doing more of that, and then ended up actually being one of the two avalanche forecasters for probably the last, I don't know, almost 25 years of the years that I worked up there in the ski hill. And it was great. Things changed through my career, but it was always a really fun and interesting job.
Where were you before you moved to Whistler?
I was brought up in Vancouver. We were always a fairly sporty family, and I learned to ski when I was a kid up on Mount Seymour, one of the local mountains. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we always did lots of activities, lots of sporting activities as kids.
When you transitioned to working for Whistler, were you intimidated by the amount of calls that the patrol was receiving?
Well, you know, not really, because I started, would have been in the late 70s, and really, Whistler was a lot smaller than it is now, and we really didn't have to respond to a lot of calls. There was only, I think, 10 people on the patrol when I started. I was the only woman when I started. Some came the next, another gal got a job the next year, but we really did a lot of skiing. We did avalanche control, and then we skied. There wasn't of the lift access to the high alpine that we have there now. Mm-hmm. And to get to some of the high alpine terrain, you had to hike up there, and thus the nice fresh powder snow lasted a lot longer than it does these days when you've got high speed lifts accessing the high alpine.
True enough. Do you have a memorable time or a memorable little anecdote about proving yourself?
Well, I just kind of remember that we didn't really have a lift access to the ridges or a lot of the terrain where we had to start our avalanche control from. So I don't know, I think I just had to make sure I was breaking trail as much as my partner would be doing, my partner who was pretty much always another male. Mm-hmm. So I just had to make sure I at least held my own or did better or was fitter.
Nice. It's good motivation.
Yeah, it is. Really good motivation.
Kind of thinking about your role as the forecaster versus patrolling, did you ever miss patrolling? Like, did you miss being out, like, on calls, on first aids, when you were more in the science side of things?
Well, I still was a part of the patrol, and there are times when it was, you know, if it didn't snow, we didn't have a lot of avalanche problems, and I wasn't so involved in the avalanche side of it, and I did more of general patrol duties, like responding to accidents or just making sure all of the fences were up for safety aspects. But when it was snowing lots, and when we were going to have to do lots of avalanche control work in the mornings, that always pretty much took up my time during the day. I had to, you know, keep my eye on what was going around the mountain during the storm and looking at the snowpack. So that, like I said, when it was snowing, that pretty much took up 100% of my time.
Yeah, right. That sounds like you had kind of a variety of tasks to do.
Yeah, I did. You know, avalanches, are made up by lots of different variables, and Whistler has a huge amount of terrain, so I needed to move around and see most of the terrain during my day. So I was on my skis pretty much all day, which was great. You know, I like to be outside, work outside.
Lovely. Having the role of choosing to open the Alpine and when to open the Alpine as the forecaster seems like it has a lot of weight to it. Do you feel like in your later years when Whistler did get more popular and there was more pressure to open the Alpine as soon as possible, did you ever feel like you questioned whether or not the Alpine should open at a certain time, or you felt pressure from like, I don't know, let's say just the bigger body of operations?
Well, you know, I never really did. We always, as a patrol, we were really proud of being able to get that high Alpine open, well, as quickly as possible, and just really trying hard to get it open for people to be able to get up there. But basically, as an avalanche forecaster, I always had last call. So if I really didn't think it was safe to open, or if I was getting feedback from the other patrollers that they didn't think it was safe to open, or if we were still in the middle of the storm and we'd go out and do the avalanche control, but then by the time you get back and have it done, it's all filled in again with
yeah.
a bunch of new snow that's been maybe moved around by the wind. So really, you know, mine was the last call, and if I didn't feel comfortable, then we didn't open.
Yeah, do you feel like you usually err on the side of caution?
Well, I tried to, you know, obviously sometimes it's a bit of a fine line. You want to get things open, yet you need to make sure that they're safe. And nowadays people ski every little patch of snow that exists. And in the old days it wasn't, you know, people weren't quite as aggressive with their skiing. So now they have to make sure that everything is controlled, even some little patch of snow in the middle of the rocks. Got to make sure there's no lingering hazard, or try not to make it too much of a lingering hazard where somebody's going to get hurt.
For some listeners who may not be as aware of patrol operations, when you say controlling avalanches, what do you mean by that?
Controlling avalanches is just trying to get rid of the snow that potentially might possibly avalanche. So if we think that the avalanche is going to be fairly small, you can just ski through it and you'll get the snow to move and make sure everything moves that's going to cause a little bit of an avalanche. But if there's more snow and we think the avalanches are going to be bigger, we'll use explosives to try and control the snow. And you know, on a day when there's been quite a bit of new snow and wind, we'll throw, you know, 100 or more hand charges to make sure that the snow comes down, the avalanches happen before the public gets up into the terrain.
Right. Do you have any memorable day of avalanche controlling, like heaviest snow day in recent memory?
Well, in the old days before we had so much skier compaction with a lot of lift access to the, you know, the high terrain, you put more people up there and the terrain gets skied more. It was great. I got to see some really huge avalanches, so that was always really fun to see. We did the control work sometimes out of a helicopter when the weather was good. So we got to see some pretty good avalanches running, some really big ones, and that's always super exciting to see.
Yeah, as we're getting into the season, I feel like it's an important time to remind ourselves of how avalanches are scaled. I know that you've probably learned a lot about the science of things. How are avalanches graded?
There's a rating scale of 1 to 5, and a 2 would be something that can kill people, and then you get up to, I think, 3 is pushing a car around, and 4 is destroying some trees in a forest, and then I think 5 is like destroying a village.
Holy.
so you can get some massive avalanches. And the ones we dealt with would be, I think the biggest probably would have been a 3.5.
Right. That's pretty massive.
It's big, yeah. We've had some pretty big avalanches and ones that are really fun to watch.
And what's, is there like kind of a, is there any type of perfect storm of weather that comes in and would just create like an incredible amount of avalanche possibility?
Well, it just depends how the snow layers develop. Sometimes you can get kind of a layer underneath that is really, the snow's really sugary, and then when you get snow and snow and more snow on top of it, it eventually reaches a point of where that sugary layer can't support the snow that comes on top of it. So and then it fails. And also wind is a huge factor in the formation of avalanches, because when it's windy, obviously you're going to get more snow piling up on the lee side. On the other side, you get more snow built up. So wind's a really important factor in the development of avalanches, and temperature is too. There's, you know, lots of different temperatures, and things can change during the day too if the temperature warms up or you get sun on a slope. So it's not a real static thing.
I know, is it operations 1 and 2 that lead you to kind of more of a forecasting role?
Yeah, not necessarily forecasting, but there's operations 1 and 2, and when you get your 2, you're kind of comfortable and you know something about avalanches. And there's a level 3 that helps you out if you, or when you are a forecaster, if you're trying to get into forecasting. But a lot of forecasting is experience, you know, just like anything else. You can take lots of courses, but you need to get some experience under your belt.
Yeah, no doubt. Did you take any courses related to weather?
Oh, for sure I did. Through my work, I took avalanche courses and some courses about weather, and yeah, it was great. The mountain supported us for, you know, more learning.
That's great. And
yeah,
I guess looking back, what initially interested you? Was it mainly the skiing aspect of patrolling that interested you?
Well, for sure it was that. I met lots of people that were patrollers, and sometimes kind of hung out with them when they were working. And it just, for me, it was really interesting being able to work outside and being able to ski. I thought it was pretty good, better than working in a bar at night.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm curious a little bit about what you did before moving to Whistler. Did you go to university?
Yeah, I did. I was a competitive tennis player, so I was spent a bit of time down in Arizona playing tennis. And then as soon as I finished my tennis career, I think I pretty much went to Whistler to get a job and stay there for one winter, and I never left.
Wow. So what did you study at Arizona State?
I pretty much studied a bit of everything, but languages were my was what I think I got my degree in, French and Spanish.
Oh.
So yeah, the languages have always interested me, and they still do.
Wow, you got a wide variety of interests.
Yeah, I do, for
sure.
That's
great. And yeah, to the listeners, I'm catching Jan before she's heading out to Spain.
Catching a plane tonight.
So, when did you retire?
This season coming up might be number 6.
Okay.
For me, so a few years ago.
Yeah. And do you still get up the mountain lots?
Yeah, I do. Not tons. I got pretty spoiled working as a patroller, having my locker there and not standing in lineup. So these days I tend to do more cross-country skiing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Great. Enjoying retirement.
Yeah, exactly. You got to find some new things and have some new goals. So it wasn't easy at first, for sure, but you know, you just got to figure out some new things and new objectives to do, and learn new things, keep your brain working.
Well, I have to say you're doing great at that, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, hope so.
All right, Jan. Well, I think those are all the questions I had for you today. Do you have any kind of closing thoughts that you want to make about patrolling or life in Whistler or anything, really?
Well, you know, if you're that kind of a person, patrolling was a really good job. And if you think you're really interested in snow and helping people and learning some first aid skills, it's worth putting the time and effort into trying to get a job and then sticking with it and even making a career out of it.
Yeah, and for people who may be interested, what do you think are the first steps?
Maybe, you know, you have to be obviously a reasonable skier. You have to be a skier, not a snowboarder.
Yeah.
And then I think maybe usually it works if you volunteer first, and then you can show that you're a hard worker and that you're capable of doing the job, and then you might have a chance to get a job.
Right.
I don't believe now, you don't have to have any courses before you get hired.
If people were interested in taking courses and learning more about snow science and avalanches, do you have any recommendations?
Well, there's a couple of courses. They're called AST 1 and 2, and those are they're just 1 or 2 day courses where you can go and kind of just get an overview of avalanches and just what's involved.
Right. Yeah, I would recommend taking those as well for anyone looking to get into backcountry skiing, even just recreationally.
Yeah, exactly. To just learn a little bit about avalanches, and you learn that you really don't know anything. So probably fairly tentative at first.
As we should be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for chatting with me today, Jan.
Well, you're welcome, Jade. It was a pleasure. I like talking about ski patrolling and avalanche forecasting.
Awesome.